Good evening, everybody. My name is Kathy, and I am recovering. I would like to thank you, Wendy, particularly, for asking me to speak tonight. It's always very helpful for me to remember how it was, what happened, and how it is today, and I thank you for that opportunity. Nothing that I'm going to say is original. Somebody told me everything. That's how I learned in this program. I just kept showing up and listening. And anything that I know, I got from somebody else, and I have to say that off the bat and very honestly. When I look back on how it was, for me that's really changing because it wasn't very long ago, actually, that I really didn't know how it was. I always thought that I had come out of a perfect home and, quite frankly, by accident had just fallen in love with an alcoholic. For me, there was always this missing link because I had listened to enough leads and certainly been to a number of meetings over the years to recognize that there must have been something in my past, in my own person, that led me to where I am today, got me where I was today. And that is still a process that is being revealed to me, I have to say. I did grow up in a family that was very close, that was loving. We were then and we still are now. There was no active alcoholism in my family, although being raised in an Irish Catholic family, there were always a lot of relatives who drank. We didn't call them alcoholics. My parents still do not call them alcoholics. They just call them Irish drunks. I don't know what the difference is, actually, except many members of my family still are very much afraid of the word alcohol and alcoholics. So sometimes I describe my mother as being an adult child of a non-alcoholic. I don't know that I was ever directly taught these things that I picked up, but I know that I learned them. And I learned them from home, and I learned them from my church, and I learned them from my community, and I learned them from society. Unfortunately, I was never a very discriminating person, and so rather than take what you like and leave the rest, I took it all in and tried to do everything right. I think that if I could characterize my background, I'd have to say that I always tried to be good. And sometimes that got me into a lot of trouble. I think that I learned that the good way to get through life and what was really important and what would make me lovable was to do the right thing. And it didn't really matter how I was feeling. It didn't really matter what I might think personally. There was a right way to do things and there was a wrong way to do things, and I was forever trying to figure out what was the right thing to do and to do it. I spent a lot of time trying to be good. And that's what I thought I was supposed to do at the time, and so that's what I did. I also learned very quickly, in my family, humor was very important. That's how we learned to deal with most crises. We just made jokes of them, and we laughed at them, and that was that. We never talked about them. We never spent time with them. We all just, it was like, you know, who can top this? Who can be the funniest? And then we went on. And I'm not so sure that's so bad, except for the fact that somewhere along there, I never learned two very important things. I never learned how to express my anger. I think that I learned very quickly that in order to be liked for me, it was important not to be angry. I was uncomfortable and afraid of angry people. And so whenever I saw anger, I would go into this routine where I would try to make everybody happy. I would try to smooth things over. I just wanted everything to go back to normal, being pleasant again. And I was very good at that. I was very good at that. And also I think that what I missed somewhere along the line, and I don't blame this on anybody, but somewhere I missed it, was learning how to set limits for myself. Learning that, you know, there are certain things in this world, there's a certain way that I could expect to be treated. I just never picked that up. I very easily fell into the role of, you know, what we say in the program as a people pleaser. And I was really good at it. And, you know, it worked for me. It worked for me for a long time. I never had any trouble with my family. I always seemed to have a lot of friends that I really thought liked me, and I never really considered being or acting another way. I thought I was a good person. I thought I was doing good things. When I met my husband, he was in flight training. He was a Marine, and he was in jet flight training, and I thought that was pretty exciting. And actually, he was a very exciting person. he was the opposite of the coin for me. Whereas I didn't express anger at all, he expressed anger in a very verbal, in a very, very verbal way. If the two of us were together at a restaurant and we both ordered hamburgers and they came raw, I would eat mine. I would eat mine with a big smile on my face and say, isn't this grand? He, of course, would go back, find the chef, throw the hamburger up against the wall. And, you know, that fascinated me that somebody, I never thought of that as being dysfunctional. I didn't even know what the word dysfunctional meant back then. But I used to think, boy, isn't that great? Isn't that great? Somebody that knows how to do that, that knows to stand up for their rights. And I was really attracted to that. That wasn't the only thing that I was attracted to. He also had a lot of wonderful qualities. But I have to say, looking back on it, he was angry a lot. And I knew that he was angry a lot. But see, I knew what to do with anger. I knew how to make people not angry. I knew how to take care of that. So it never occurred to me that his anger would be a problem once we were married. Once we were married and we were living together, I thought, I can fix him. I can make him happy. I can make him laugh. I can show him, you know, how nice life can be. He'll get over this bad temper of his. Now today I can see that as being very arrogant, but then I thought I was being very good. I mean, this was like a challenge of mine. This was my, well, this was my mission. And so the other thing about my husband is that he drank, but I never considered his drinking to be a problem for two reasons. Number one, because his father was a well-known drunk. I mean, I had heard about his father years before I even met him. And so I knew that anybody who had a father that was that well known of a drunk would never drink. I mean, that just stands to reason. And the other thing was that when my husband drank, he was a very neat drinker. He used to drink out of a silver monogrammed cup. That was impressive. And he never got drunk. I mean, he never got drunk. He used to drink straight bourbon, and he never fell down, he never threw up on me, I didn't even consider it, didn't even think about it. And so we were married. And I can say, you know, looking back on it now, actually, I wasn't quite sure that we were getting married. We had discussed it, but his mother was in the hospital dying. Actually, she didn't die for years and years and years later, but we thought she was dying. And I was at his home. He has a big family. His father was there and his seven brothers and sisters. And he announced at dinner that we were getting married. I was a little surprised. But it would not have looked good for me to have said, we are soon? Is this going to be soon? So I went along with it. Now today that just seems crazy to me that I would go along with that. But I really loved him and I really didn't have anything else planned, and so I thought, well, I can do that. I can do that. You see, I never had developed within myself a sense of, wait a minute here. I was, you know, it just wouldn't have looked right. It just wouldn't have looked good, so I was willing to go along. And so we were married, and I always tell this story whenever I have the opportunity, because for me, it very clearly demonstrates what happened then for the next 12 years. My husband was in the service, and at the time he was stationed in Cherry Point, North Carolina, which is a Marine Air Station located in Havelock, North Carolina. And so we drove immediately down there because he had no leave. And at the time, he was living in a trailer, in a trailer camp. And so I joined him, being married to him, I joined him in that trailer. And about 10 days, and it wasn't even 2 weeks, 10 days after we were married, he was gone on a hop, flying somewhere, and a package arrived in the mail. It was a wedding gift from Cincinnati, and it, you know, was stamped glass, fragile glass. So I opened it up and took out all the straw, and it was some sort of glassware, and I put all the glasses away, took the box outside of the trailer, threw it in the garbage can. And when my husband came home that night, I said, oh, you know, we got a wedding gift. And he said, did you open it? And I said, sure. And he said, wasn't it addressed to both of us? And I said, well, yeah. And he said, don't you know it's against federal law to open somebody else's mail? And I thought, he's kidding. 10 days, He's kidding. This is a joke he's playing. And he said, and not only that, but there's straw all over the yard. Now, you have to imagine, this trailer camp that we were living in, and there are a number of nice trailer camps, but we were not living in one of those. We were living in one that, I don't know, it just looked like somebody said this would be a great place to park our trailer, and then everybody else followed suit. It was just kind of on the side of the road. There was no pavement or anything. It was just kind of a dirt road, a dirt block. So I wasn't that concerned. I mean, I didn't even know what our yard was. So I thought, well, see, I was stumped here. I mean, I had nothing to fall back on here. I just didn't know what to do. I thought, well, I guess I could pick up the straw. But something inside of me said, that's crazy. That's crazy. But I ignored that. I ignored that. And I went out and I picked up the straw and I came back in to get into the trailer and the door was locked. And I knocked on the door and I said, you know, Ricky, it's your bride. And he said, you missed some straw. So I was dumb, but I wasn't that dumb. I should say I was sick, but I wasn't that sick. I thought, this is crazy. So I left. Now, there aren't a lot of places to go in Havelock, North Carolina at that hour. Well, even at noon, there weren't many places to go. But so I went into up on the highway. I walked up on the highway, and there was a Sears catalog store, and there was a furniture store, and the catalog store was closed. So I went into the furniture store, and I just wandered around. And I remember, as though it were yesterday, I remember feeling very confused about what had happened. I remember feeling angry. I remember feeling frightened because I had a sense that there was something going on here that was beyond me. I felt like I was in over my head, and I didn't know what it was, and I couldn't explain it to you, but I had a foreboding sense that there was something wrong that I couldn't fix. And I remember being so angry with him. But most of all, I remember being angry with me because I didn't know what to do. My first instinct was to get out, just to go back, wait till he fell asleep or wait till he took off for work, get the checkbook and get to New Bern, North Carolina and fly home and just say, Mom, Dad, something's wrong. I made a mistake. I got to come home. But I didn't do that because I knew that would not look good. And again, you know, I have to say, appearances were very important to me then. Looking good was important. How would that look? Married 10 days? I mean, I could just see, you know, walking down the street. There she goes. She's married 10 days. She goes, blah, blah, blah. There that woman goes. She was married 10 days, and then she blew up. I didn't want to do that. I used to do that to other people, but I didn't want anybody to do it to me, you know? And so I just ignored that. And what I did was I took those feelings, that anger, that fear, that confusion, and I just ignored it. They didn't go away, but I just ignored them. And I went back, and I picked up that straw, and I put it in the garbage can, and I gritted my teeth. And I think that I went through the next 12 years gritting my teeth, and I went back in. Now, I've had some old man one time when I gave a lead came up to me afterwards and he said, I'm so mad at you. And I said, why is that? And he said, because why did you stay? And I have to say, the reason that I stayed is because things like that did not happen all the time. In between those things, my husband was a very loving, caring, gentle, funny man. Every once in a while, he became Adolf Hitler. But in between there, you know, there were a lot of good things there. And plus, I was, you know, for whatever reason, right or wrong, I was in love with the man. When we were in the military, I don't know how many of you have been in the military, but in the military, it's very easy to drink. They have happy hours, they have package stores where the liquor is very cheap, and plus my husband was in a squadron that had Vietnam ahead of them. And very soon after we were married, he got his orders that he would have to go to Vietnam. Now, I had noticed my husband did not drink every day, but at parties on the weekends, he hit it pretty good. And the only thing that I noticed about his drinking was that when he drank, unlike a lot of the other men he drank with, he was not funny. When my husband drank, he got mean and he got obnoxious. And he never hit anybody, but he would always get so obnoxious that somebody would finally beat him up. And I never knew when that was coming. But whenever we were at a party and I would notice him drink, I would get nervous. and my stomach would get into a knot, and I would watch him drink. I don't know why I did that. I guess I thought that as long as I kept count, I would know how scared to be. I mean, that seems crazy today, but I had to watch him. I just had to watch him. I had to know how many he was drinking, when I should be, you know, start to be more quiet, when, because that's what I would do. When he would drink, I would get very, very quiet. I did not want to get in his way. I did not want to make him angry because I was very, very afraid of his anger. Now, when we would drive home from these parties, if I would say, and I was a good learner. I was a quick learner. If we would drive home and he was drunk and he would be driving 90 miles an hour and I would say, Rick, you're going 90 miles an hour, he would go 120. So I learned, don't ever say, Rick, you're going 90 miles an hour. Just keep your mouth shut. I never even thought that what I could have done was not get in the car. That never crossed my mind. What I learned was get in the car, put on your seatbelt, have a rosary in your right hand, but don't say anything, or you'll go 120. I thought that was so clever of me to have figured that one out. So eventually my husband did get sent to Vietnam, and I have to say honestly, I couldn't wait. Unlike all the other wives that I used to meet with who were all very upset, and what are we going to do, and they'll be gone for a year, and we're so nervous, I couldn't wait. I'd only been married for 4 months, but I thought that I needed a break because it was too much for me. I always felt like I was being overwhelmed. It was just too much for me. I couldn't wait for the man to leave, but I could never say that. There wasn't a living soul that I could have shared that with. So what I did was I pretended, and I would say things to him like, oh, what am I going to do when you're gone, and oh, I'm going to miss you, and oh, I hope you're safe, and I really did hope he was safe. I did hope that he would be captured. That's the only thing that I could think of. I used to think maybe if they would capture him and torture him just a little bit, nothing serious, nothing permanent, but just maybe that would be what it would take to straighten him up, so that it would just turn him around. It would be a spiritual experience for him, and it would turn him around, and he would act right. But that didn't happen. They never caught him. I used to say that mean them. They'll never shoot him, and they never caught him. And so he came back, and when he came back, things really were pretty much the same as they always were. I never made a connection with the drinking, never once. But while he was gone for that year, it was one of the few times in my married life that I did not have a knot in my stomach, that I wasn't constantly thinking, oh, what's he going to say? What's he going to do? What's he going to say? What if I do this? What if I do that? You know, I was constantly, that's how I used to spend a great deal of my life with him before I got into the program, wondering, if I say this, what will he do? If I do this, what will he say? If I go here and I don't get back, if I'm a half hour late, what will he say? I was so focused on his reaction. And that was true for me from the very beginning. I would have done anything just to keep him happy. I would have done anything to avoid that anger. I would have done anything to avoid his being upset or unpleasant. I was never comfortable with his feelings, with his negative feelings. I was never comfortable with that. And so when he came back from Vietnam, things pretty much, you know, stayed the way that they were. Eventually, he got out of the service and decided that he wanted to be a dentist. I have no idea how that transition happened, but that's what he decided. And we went up to Columbus, to Ohio State, and with the GI Bill, he studied dentistry. Prior to his going up there, he had been in a real ugly incident over in Newport, Kentucky, with a Vietnam buddy of his, and he had gotten bounced so badly by a bouncer that he required plastic surgery. And so he stopped drinking. For the whole 3 years that we were in Columbus, he did not drink. And while we were up there, we were involved in a marriage group, and we were very, very close. It probably were three of the finest years of our marriage. Things were just great. And I thought, gee, all that in the beginning. That must have just been what they call a period of adjustment. Everything's fine now. Isn't this grand? Everything's great. I'm happy. He's happy. The kids are happy. This is terrific. And so we left Columbus and we came back to Cincinnati for him to set up a practice, and very, very quickly, and this is why it's easy for me to see that this disease is progressive, very, very quickly, within months of our return, things had gone back to where they were before we went into Columbus. As a matter of fact, they were even worse. I did not know what was going on, but I honestly thought that my husband was losing his mind. I thought he was going crazy, and I did not know what to do about that. I never told anybody because I felt that there was this bond between husband and wife where there were things that you just kept between the two of you. I had never really, I have to say, growing up, I don't know what it is. I mean, I don't know if it was just my family. I don't know if it's vestiges of alcoholism, if it's being Irish, if it's being Catholic. I don't know. But growing up, we were told, or I learned, I should say, to keep things to yourself, that you don't hang out your dirty laundry for everyone to see. You take care of things, you always be gracious and always put on a good face and a smile. So when this happened, it was just against my grain, really, to share that with anybody. I just really thought the man was going crazy. His behavior was very, very bizarre. He always seemed like he was tired. He was trying to set up a practice, and I knew that was stressful. He was short-tempered. But that's, you know, what happened to me was, once again, that fear returned. Once again, I was afraid. Once again, I was always second-guessing myself, never trusted myself to do the right thing. When I'd do something wrong, would get angry with myself. I always felt that there was a formula, and if I could figure out that formula, he would be happy. And if he was happy, then I would be happy. And that's the way that I thought that it worked. Eventually, he told me that he, two things. He told me that he was on drugs, and that he had been caught, and that the Reno agents were looking for him to arrest him. Well, I was relieved. Now, that sounds crazy, but I thought, oh, thank God it's only drugs. I thought you were insane. Little did I know. I never saw there was a connection there. I mean, I knew drinking, but I didn't know drugs, and I had missed the drugs completely. I knew there was something wrong because, I mean, he would do things like at night, he would always smoke in bed, which used to worry me, and he would always be dozing off, and I was so afraid that he would fall asleep with a cigarette in his hand and burn all of us, you know, to cinders. But rather than say, don't smoke in bed, I would wait till he was asleep and roll, I mean literally roll off the bed on my side, go on my hands and knees all around the end of the bed, and then feel all over his side to make sure that if he had dropped that cigarette, it was out. I just thought I was so brave for doing that. I thought that was a brilliant, brilliant thing I was doing. But here I was on my hands and knees. And at this time, I think I was pregnant with my fifth child. And here I am on my hands and knees with my belly dragging along the floor, putting out a fire. Anyway, that just seemed real normal to me. this didn't happen all at once. I'm beginning to see that now. There was so much that was there in me, you know, so many fears that I brought into this relationship, so many inabilities of my own that just mushroomed, and that happened to both of us. It didn't happen to just one of us. It happened to both of us, and eventually it happened to all of us. And so my husband got thrown out of dentistry. He did stop using drugs. He went on to alcohol for a while, but eventually he even stopped that. But things did not really improve. As a matter of fact, things really got worse because now he wasn't sleeping as much. Now he seemed to be awake more, and he was home a lot because he didn't work. And he didn't work for the next 5 years. He was unemployed, and he continued to, you know, just borrow money from wherever he could get it. I used to worry a lot about that unemployment, and I used to say, gee, Ricky, you know, are you thinking about getting a job? And he would say, there's milk in the refrigerator, isn't there? And I'd think, well, yeah, there is. I guess I shouldn't complain. And that was my attitude. But I thought maybe if I did something, it would make him change. And so I tried all kinds of things. I tried being nasty. You know, I would put on this real gruff, which was ridiculous because inside I was scared to death. But I would say things to him like, now look, something's got to change here. Something's wrong, and we've just got to fix it. And if you don't fix it, then you're going to have to leave. And he'd say, well, I'm not going anywhere. This is my house. Oh, that doesn't work. All right, now I'll try being real nice. So I would try that. And sometimes I would make up things that I would think of, like I would pretend like I was this poor old woman and that he had taken in off the streets. And then I would think that way so that I'd do anything to try to conjure up some sort of kind feelings towards this man that I was really growing to hate. So I would do things like he would lie in bed a lot. So I would go up and decide that I was going to repaint the windows in our bedroom. So, and I would, of course, wait till I was 9 months pregnant to do this. So I was very good at getting pregnant. So I would get a blowtorch, you know, and I would take this blowtorch and I would scrape the paint off. And then as I would turn to him as he lay in bed and I would say, are you thirsty? Can I get you a Coke or something? Just thinking, if he says yes, then I'll know that he really is the slime of the world. And he would always say, yeah, I don't mind if you do get me a Coke. So I'd put down the blowtorch and put down the scraper and run down the steps, thinking, he's just got to one day wake up and say, oh my God, how can I be so nasty? I've got to change. I've got to go back. I've got to get a job. I've got to act right. It never worked. And the more those things didn't work, the angrier I got, the more I resented him, and actually, the more fearful I became. I was at my wit's end without even knowing it. I used to run the sweeper upstairs crying because there was no work. And I would think, what am I going to do when I'm in my 60s? He doesn't work. I'll never be Social Security. I'll be a bag lady. I'll have to go down to Findlay Market at 11 o'clock and 12 o'clock and pick up cabbage leaves out of garbage cans, and all my friends will go by and they'll say, there's poor Kathy, the bag lady. What happened to her? She used to be so smart. She was always so good. So, there was just a whole lot of fear that I was living with. And I think the worst part for me was the kids, because I thought that if I could just... One thing that I could do was to prevent the children from knowing the situation. If anything, I knew I could do that. I mean, I thought I had snowed pretty much my parents, his family, my friends. There was one friend from out of town that wrote me once and said, hey, don't you see all you're doing is nursing a sick bird? And I never wrote her again. I was so angry with her, and I can see now I was angry with her because... She saw it. I mean, she did not, as many of my friends were doing, say things to me like, boy, only you could do this, or you don't know how much I admire you for sticking in there. Those are the kinds of things that kept me going for years, and I mean literally years. She didn't say that, so I didn't write her anymore. But I used to think for the kids, well, at least I can fool the kids. And so I would do things like, without thinking that it was abnormal at all, my husband was a hunter. When he quit work, he used to trap fox, red fox preferably, sometimes muskrat, but mostly red fox. But he also would hunt squirrel and groundhogs or whatever he could shoot. And sometimes, he was a very good aim, he always had been, I think particularly in the Marines, that was sharpened up for him. But he could even, and he did this on occasion, he would lie in bed. And we lived in somewhat a rural area. He would open the bedroom window, and from his bed, he could shoot a squirrel or a bird right through the window into the tree. It was great. I thought it was terrific he could do such a thing. But I would have to say to the children, I would have to yell outside and say, hey kids, don't play on that side of the house. Dad's hunting. Go over there with all your friends. And I used to try to present him as being this wonderful... I mean, I used to say to your kids, aren't you lucky? You don't have a boring father that works 9 to 5 like all your other little playmates. Your father's a hunter. Isn't that great? Look at this. Come, let's watch Dad skin this fox outside my kitchen door. That was very strange, but I did not see that as being strange. When they would come home with applications from... when they would come home from school every year with those forms that you have to fill out, when it would get to father's occupation, it used to drive me crazy because I did not know what to put. I couldn't put hunter. It just doesn't go in the 1980s. So I used to put independent businessman. I thought, all these years, I thought that I was doing a wonderful job of holding things together. I thought that I had everybody fooled, but I also knew that I was just, you know, I always felt like I was just holding on by the ends of my fingers. And if anything could upset the whole balance here. I had no idea of how I was feeling inside because I long ago had stopped feeling. I knew that I cried a lot when I was alone. I knew that I was very, very sad, and I couldn't tell you why. And I knew that I was, well, I did not know that I was angry. I just knew that I was sad. And so what happened eventually was, my husband, as I said, comes from a big family, and a number of his sisters got into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Where we lived at the time, we lived around his family, and so it was really close living. And my relationship with his family, I thought had always been a good one. However, they often would come up and say things to me, you know, come into my house and say, why don't you keep your glasses above the dishwasher? Why do you keep them all the way over there? If you kept your glasses above the dishwasher, it would save you so much time. Why don't you pinch back your geraniums in the garden? If you don't push back the geraniums in the garden, they won't bloom right. Why do you make your beds that way? You know, they were always giving me advice. And I was an easy mark. You know, I'd say, oh, yes, okay. And I'd run out and I'd pinch back the geraniums and I'd move all the glasses. I mean, I was such a geek when I think about it. But at any rate, now they were on a new kick. That's the way that I saw it. And so they would come up to my kitchen and they'd start to talk about alcoholism. And I thought, oh no, now here we go again. Here's something new that I'm going to have to try, I guess. And they talked about alcoholism, and they had all these wonderful sayings, and no matter what I would come up with, the arguments I would come up with, they would counter it with something else. Two things actually pushed me in, one of which was they decided to do an intervention on my mother-in-law. And my husband said to me, if you participate in that intervention, I'm going to call your brother-in-laws and run an intervention on your mother. I said, but Ricky, my mother doesn't drink. And he'd say, I don't care. I'm going to do it anyway. And the thought of that, and I knew he would, the vision of my poor mother being slammed into Bethesda Hospital and saying, but I don't drink, and everyone saying, you're just in denial. And then I thought, oh, my God, she'll never get out. That scared me. That really scared me, because I didn't know what to do, because his mother did drink, and I loved his mother, and I have all these people on one side who obviously have a hold of something that's making sense to me, and then I've got him on the other side. Well, as it turned out, they never asked me to participate anyway. But the other thing was that they kept talking about this being a family disease. By the time I got into the program, I was pregnant with my 7th child, and the thought of this being a family disease was too much for me. I had always operated on my 8-year plan, which is to say, my husband was 4 years older than I was, and because women generally live 4 years longer than their husbands, I figured at the end of my life I would have 8 years of relative peace. And I used to always look at that, you know, well, I'll have those 8 years at the end. Well, needless to say, when they told me that it was a family disease, I thought, my God, there goes my 8-year plan. I'll have to sit down with, I mean, if I have to contend with this in my own children, that will be the factor that will upset my balance. And so what I decided to do on my own was to go and find out what I could about this disease called alcoholism. And I didn't tell anybody I was going, and I went to a meeting that was so far away, I was almost in West Virginia, and I went to a beginner's meeting, and the very first night that I walked in, a woman that was running the beginner's meeting told me that two things. First of all, she told me that alcoholism was a disease, that I didn't cause it, that I could not cure it, and that I could not control it. Now, I never had thought that I had caused this, but I always thought that I should be able to cure it. Always. Always thought that if I were loving enough, if I were loyal enough, if I were true enough, if I prayed sincerely enough, I would be able to cure this problem, whatever it was. The other thing she said to me, I was very concerned because at the time my husband was not using drugs or alcohol. I was very concerned that maybe I was in the wrong place, and maybe he really wasn't an alcoholic or a drug addict, and maybe, you know, it was unfair of me to label him as such. And she said to me, doesn't matter. You need to be here for you. This is a program for you. And I can say honestly that I did not really come to understand that for years and years in the program. And so I went, and all I knew was this, that this was the very first place I had ever been where I sat down with men and women who sounded similar to me. It was the very first time anybody had ever connected with me at a real deep level. My friends, as well-meaning as they were, had no idea what I was involved in. And quite frankly, they were so blinded by their loyalty to me, they never could see me objectively. They could never see me as part of the problem. I mean, Rick was so obviously the boogeyman. And he used to say to me, "Why do you always paint me into being the boogeyman?" And I'd say, "Because, Rick, you make such a good boogeyman. I mean, you're so perfect for the role." And so when I got into this program, it was the first time someone didn't say to me things like, "Kathy, why don't you just sit down with him and talk to him?" I mean, when people would say those things to me, I was so insulted, as though I hadn't thought about, talking to someone. But you don't talk somebody out of a disease. And so here I was with men and women who began to tell stories that I had heard before, because they were my story. And they began to talk about feelings that I thought that I might have. And they began to talk about another way to live. And for me, I noticed that they seemed to be happy. That's one of the things that struck me about those Al-Anon meetings, is that here was a group of people who were laughing, whose situation in many cases were the same as mine, but they were able to laugh, and they were able to live lives, to me, that seemed to be lives of dignity and lives of serenity. And so I kept coming back. And I don't even know why I did, because I had no idea how much I needed that program. I just knew that when I was at an Al-Anon meeting, I felt safe and I felt like I was at home. Eventually, someone came up to me after a meeting and they said, "You know, Kathy, you will never get well until you admit that you are sick too." And I had so much trouble with that. I used to think to myself, "You think I'm sick? If you want to see sick, you ought to come home with me and meet Genghis Khan. I am the sanest person I know within a 10-mile radius of my home." It was so hard for me to accept my own disease. But that didn't stop me, and eventually, just from listening to men and women like yourself, I began to recognize that I was powerless over the disease of alcoholism, and that my life had become unmanageable. And up until that point, I thought that I was living a very normal, reasonably sane life. As a matter of fact, I thought that my life was far saner than most people's. But coming to meetings, I began to see that that just was not so. And bit by bit, just from listening, I began to see that I had no power to cure or to control this disease. Step two tells me, came to believe in the power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. I always believed in a power greater than myself, but I have to say that I've learned through this program that power for me has gone through a process of change, as I have too. A friend of mine gave her fourth step to a priest who was not in the program, and after she gave her fourth step, he said to her, "Gee, alcoholism has really hollowed you out, hasn't it?" And I'll never forget that phrase when she told me that, when she relayed that to me, because that indeed to me is what alcoholism does to all of us. It hollows us out. And that's how I felt. I felt like somebody had just ripped my insides out and that I was a shell. But I also believe that restoring me to sanity means restoration is usually done on things of value. I don't know anybody that restores something that is of no value. And I think alcoholism for me had stripped me of my own belief that I was worthwhile and that I was of value. And that is something that this 12-step program has returned to me. It's given back to me my self-esteem, and it's led me to see that I am worthwhile and that I am of value, and that I am worthy of being restored. And I think that the God of my understanding does that in a very gentle way, just as we restore things that are valuable, very gently, but very assuredly that it's done. I know that my understanding of God has changed, because when I was a kid, and even into my adulthood, I lugged this adolescent idea of God with me. I used to believe in a God to whom it was very important that you did the right thing. I believed in a God who was a God of success, and I believed in a God looking good. And through alcoholism, I have come to see, and I've come to believe in a God who is a God of failure, a God of weakness, and a God of powerlessness. And I see that most men and women that touch me today are men and women who are failures. That's what brought me to Al-Anon, is that I failed. And I imagine that I'm in a room full of failures, because I don't know why you'd be here if things worked. And that to me then became, you know, I began, my whole understanding of God changed. My God became far more maternal, quite frankly, than paternal. And I began to believe in a God that did not keep score. I always believed it was important to rack up those points, you know, and if you got enough points, boy, you just made a beeline into heaven. And I don't believe that today. What I believe is important for me is that I choose truth, that I choose to be healthy. It's the direction of my life that is important, not so much all those little things, because I truly believe in a God who is divine, but who really is rooted in humanness. And for me, humanness has a lot to do with weakness. And today I can accept that, and today I like that. One time, not so long ago, I went to Washington, D.C. to visit a friend of mine. And while we were there, we went to visit her sister. And her sister lives in a lovely suburb of Washington, D.C., in a lovely little white house with a white picket fence, with a rose garden in front and a thriving vegetable garden in the back. And they have 2.5 children and a dog and a station wagon in the driveway. And as we left, I said to my friend, that's what I thought my life was going to be. And I almost killed myself trying to make it into that. The third step tells me, made a decision to turn my life and will over to the care of God as I understand God. And that is what I find it is necessary for me to do today. Because it's easy for me to slip back into that white picket fence, thriving, you know, vegetable garden in the back. And I can't, you know, I cannot allow myself the luxury of taking control of my own life because it just doesn't work for me. I have to turn it over. And I do that by beginning every day on my knees saying the third step prayer from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only way I know to do it. That for me is making a decision. Truly believing that there is a power greater than myself that knows what is good for me and that will lead me if I am willing to be led. And all I can do is make that decision. And there are a lot of days when I screw up, and there are a lot of days when I take things in my own hand and I get back into control. But they're far less, and they're far fewer, and you know, they're fewer and further in between than they ever have been before. And that's okay for me. And I believe today in a God that really wants me to be happy, joyous, and free, and whose plans for me knows no limits. Because I can look back now and see what I wanted for me was very, very limited, was really very small. And thank God I didn't get what I prayed for. Thank God I didn't settle for so less. Because the power greater than myself has shown me that the dreams and plans and hopes are far greater than what I would ever have expected for me. Nothing really changed for me, I have to admit, until I did a fourth step, until I got a sponsor. Those first three steps for me were most important in keeping down my panic level and just laying the groundwork for what would take place later. Eventually, I was discovered in the program of Al-Anon by a family member, and the way I was discovered was that my brother-in-law actually came to my little hidden meeting and gave a lead. Oh, boy. And I like my brother-in-law. Liked him a lot then, like him a lot today. And when he gave his lead, he talked about two things that I did not do and had not done. One was make a fourth step, and the other one was get a sponsor. And I knew I wanted what he had. And I find that's how this program works. When I see something that I want, I listen and see what that person does that I'm missing, and then I do it. I'm a great imitator. Nothing I've ever done is original. And so that next day, I got a sponsor, and I started to work on my fourth step. I am amazed at how many years I spent gathering evidence against my husband. I spent so much time watching him that I never paid any attention to me. The fourth step tells me that I have to take responsibility and be willing to make that fearless and honest moral inventory, or I'll never get better. For me, it's the difference between coming to Al-Anon for somebody else and coming to Al-Anon for me. For which I have to take responsibility, I'll never get better. And I used to come to Al-Anon a lot saying that I was here for me, but really believing that I wouldn't be here if I hadn't married somebody that was actively alcoholic. And today I see more and more and more how untrue that is. You know, how much I brought into this situation. And it just mushroomed, you know. It's like Miracle-Grow alcoholism is. It just feeds and exaggerates every defect of character in both of us. You know, and it's progressive. So the fourth step, for me, it took me a while to do that. And I did it the best that I could at the time, and I believe that that was sufficient. I was honest as I knew how to be then. The fifth step, admitted to myself, to God, and to another human being the exact natures of my wrong, I have always found that real healing takes place in this program for me when I share it with somebody else. And that's something that is new for me and continues to be new for me, to give it away, to say it to somebody else. And when I gave my fourth step to my sponsor, she was marvelous. I mean, it was a good experience for me because she just kind of nodded her head, would smile, would say, "Oh, I know." And that was really about it. If nothing else, it really convinced me that I was exactly where I should be. But the fourth and fifth steps also led me to make a commitment to this program, that the decision that I was making about being involved in this was going to be a permanent one. The sixth step says, became entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. I think for me, it is important for me to know, again, that what I really wanted out of this program was to be human. That's what I really wanted back. I was so burnt out by alcoholism by the time I got here that all I wanted back again was to be able to laugh when I was happy, to be able to cry when I was sad, to be able to be angry when I was angry. There's a great Al-Anon joke that I've heard many times, and I'm sure many of you have heard it too, that I just love. And it's a joke about the two nuns that go to the zoo. There's two nuns that go to the zoo, and real old nuns, and they're peering in at the gorilla, and all of a sudden the gorilla reaches through the bar and grabs one of the old nuns, pulls her into the cage, rips off her habit, ravishes her, abuses her. It's just terrible, horrible. And when he's finished, he throws her back out on the sidewalk. And the little nun that's with her picks her up and dusts her off and says, "Oh, sister, how can I help you?" And she says, "Don't ever mention this to anybody. And don't ever mention this incident again." So years and years and years pass, and the two little nuns are in the retirement nun center, and they're on the front porch in their rockers. And the little nun turns to the ravaged nun, and she says, "You know I promised I would never mention it again, but I just have to ask you. Did it hurt?" And the old nun turns to her and says, "Hurt? He never wrote. He never called. He never sent flowers." You know, and the reason that I like that is because it reminds me of how backwards things got for me, how willing I was to accept unacceptable behavior. I have a number of people, friends of me, friends of mine, that say there are no victims, only volunteers. And that did not make much sense to me a few years ago, but today I can see that. I can see how willingly I was a volunteer. I wonder sometimes if I didn't have something written on my forehead, step on me, I like it. and that's changed for me. But I also know that knowledge leads me to that point where I am entirely ready, where I can look back and say, I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to live that life anymore. When I'm honest about it, and when that honesty out of that fourth and fifth step, I can say, I don't want to do that anymore. I want things to be different. I want to be better. I want to get well. I want to have a full, healthy life. That's what I want. And I don't know how to get that for myself, and that's why I have to do the seventh step and humbly ask God to remove those defects of character, knowing that all my defects won't be removed, and that's okay, because God really speaks to me truly more through my weaknesses than He does through my strengths, and that's a good thing for me. My defects of character, quite frankly, keep me humble, and they keep me very reliant on a power greater than myself, and I believe that God can work through my defects. But I also know there have been times when I have been very, very afraid and I have received courage. It doesn't mean I'm a brave person every day. Quite frankly, most days I'm a coward. But I know that when I have asked, I've been supplied with what I needed at the time. And I like knowing that. That to me is a miracle. It truly is. The eighth step says made a list for people we had harmed and becoming willing to make amends to them all. It took me a long time to become willing to make amends to everybody on my list. Actually, it took me a long time to make a list because I wasn't quite sure who it was that I'd hurt. I kept thinking, well, gee, I've always been so nice. I've never hurt anybody's feelings. I never say anything against anybody. Until somebody in the program pointed out to me that one of the people that I had to put on that list was myself, that I really had damaged myself a lot, and I needed to make amends to myself for that. And also then I began to see that I had really distanced myself a lot from my friends, that I had isolated myself. Because I didn't like myself much, if I had met me on the street, I never would have befriended me. I didn't like me. And so as a result, I had those feelings, of low self-esteem. I needed to, once that was built up again, I needed to reestablish some of those friendships. And I needed to do that. I needed to put my children on the list because I know that I really had not been present to my children. I had been there, but I hadn't been present. I was always living in the past, you know, nursing old wrongs, thinking about past wounds. I was either doing that or I was way down the road, you know, living out my life in my 60s as the bag lady of Finley Market. But I was never there in the present for my kids. I used to say things to my kids like, oh, I wish you'd know me when I was 18. I was so much fun. You know, what a drag, really, when I think about it. How awful. I was so busy, you know, being the beacon of righteousness, doing the right thing, saying the right thing, being so noble. You know, and that is, I mean, I was so busy doing that, I couldn't parent. I couldn't be a mother. And then I knew that I had to put my husband on that list too. Because as I began to just become aware of my part in this disease, and that's right out of the fourth step, you know, my angers, my resentments, who they're directed against, and my part in it. When I began to see my part in all of this, I knew that eventually I'd have to make amends to my husband. And all I could do was to become willing and wait for that to happen. With my kids, it was pretty easy because they were all so little. It became clear to me that the best way I could make amends to them and to me was to continue in recovery. And that wasn't always easy for me because my husband at the time was not in a recovery program and they were afraid of him. They were afraid of him because he would yell, because when I would leave, he'd say things like, let's surprise Mom when she's gone. Let's clean the house. Everybody get out their toothbrushes. We're going to start with the corners. And they would all say, oh, my God. I mean, you know, it was a nightmare. And they'd all, you know, here they were, these little kids with these toothbrushes cleaning the corners and things. So when I would say, I'm going to a meeting now, all seven little eyes would turn and look at me like, you're kidding. You're leaving us here with him. And it was hard. I mean, it was hard for me because my instinct was, no, I better stay. I better stay, and I'll clean out the corners so they don't have to do it, and I'll fix it, and I'll, because that's what my role had always been, you know, referee. You know, I was always running interference. Oh, Ricky, the kids didn't mean that, or, oh, kids, Dad didn't mean that. This is what he meant. I was a constant interpreter, trying to protect them from each other. Al-Anon taught me to get out of the middle, to get out of there, that I had no business being there. But what I really was doing was, you know, I was being manipulative. I was trying to play God in everybody's life. And as my sponsor said to me one time, Kathy, if you are God in your children's life, why will they ever search for God on their own? And I saw that as being such a valuable thing. And so I had to leave. And so I would just get in that car and leave, even with those faces at the window. And I would just have to remind myself that this is how I could make amends. To get better myself is how I could become a better parent. By caring for myself physically, spiritually, and emotionally, I would be a better person and hence a better parent. But that took a lot of encouragement from men and women like you to convince me of that, because there were days when I just wasn't sure of that. I was afraid of that. And I had to make that leap of faith that we all have to make in this program, and just to believe in the program, to believe in the people in the program, and again, to believe in a power greater than ourselves. Eventually, I made amends to my husband. I went to him and I had to say to him, hey, you know, there are so many times when I have set you up. There are so many times when I have really, you know, I did such a great job of painting you and making you into the boogeyman. And I'm sorry about that. And I'm very grateful that that happened, because about 4.5 years ago, my husband was killed suddenly in a crash. And I have to say that that last year and a half that we were together and when I was in the program were really good years for us. They were really good years for us. He drifted into the program and drifted out of the program. But the power of a 12-step program going on in that house made a difference. It diffused a lot of tension. A lot of the blaming that I was just an expert at had ceased. And things were really getting better one day at a time. And I will always be grateful to the program of Al-Anon that those amends were made. I see today, 4.5 years later, that there's, oh boy, I mean, I'm just uncovering all the time more and more amends that I need to make to him. And I do that. I do that in my own way. And I believe that it's okay, because I know today my husband is in recovery. I know today he is in a peace of serenity, and that's a good thing. The 10th step says, continue to take personal inventory, and when I was wrong, promptly admit it. This is an important step for me because it's the only way that I can maintain any kind of spirituality is if I stick with it. I write things down, which is helpful for me. I also, when I don't write things down, or sometimes I do both of them, I'll call somebody immediately, or almost immediately. Well, usually immediately. See, I'm lying already. Most of the time I do that. It makes me feel better when I do that. If I call somebody and say, ah, you know what I'm doing? This is what I'm doing. This is why I think I'm doing it. What do you think of it? You know, if I get rid of it, right away if I get on it. My oldest son, shortly after my husband's death, went right into drugs and alcohol. Actually, he'd already been in them. Neither of us knew that, but it just got worse, accelerated. And he was bounced in and out of programs, you know, throughout Cincinnati and northern Ohio, eventually landing in jail. And that was hard for me to let that child go. Actually, I had to put him in jail. I had to sign one of those, kept signing, you know, signing all the time. I was down there at 2020 Auburn Avenue signing warrants. And I did it because that's what people told me to do. People told me that I had to stop enabling this child, that I had to learn this child, you know, this kid had to take the consequences of his behavior. And eventually the consequences of his behavior got him into jail. That to me, if you had told me that would ever happen to one of my kids, that to me would have been the worst scenario you could have ever possibly have painted for me. As a matter of fact, my husband used to say, that kid needs to be in jail. And I would think, oh, Ricky, you need to be in jail, you fool, he doesn't need to be in jail. I mean, I used to think, what a rotten thing to say. But you know, he was right. He needed to be in jail, and he got into jail. And he said to me one day when I went to visit him, hey, Mom, I found God in jail. I said, you found God in jail? I spent all that money on a Catholic education, and you found God in jail? I could have saved myself a fortune. When I came home that night, I called somebody in the program and I said, guess what? Mark says he found God in jail. And they said, well, Kathy, what did you think? God doesn't operate in jail? I thought, oh, yeah, see, there I go again. There I go again, limiting that power of God. Of course God works in jail. And my son then went on into a program which he decided finally to take seriously. And today he's doing quite well as a freshman in college and he's okay today. I think he's okay today. But quite frankly, I don't think much about him. I've really detached from him. And I've been able to do that through this program. I guess he's okay. He does not choose to be part of a 12-step program, and that's the way it is for him. Because Al-Anon teaches me, I have to be in charge of my own program. I have to be responsible for my own disease. I cannot fix somebody else's disease, even when it's my own children's. I can't do that for them. I can wish them well. I can invite them to join me. But if they don't want to, that's their choice. Everybody has to follow their own path. And, you know, as I said to somebody the other day, I just can't destroy my own serenity for that. It would be a shame if I destroyed my own serenity and the kid joined the Jesuits or something when he was 35. I mean, he's going to have to find his own way, and I'm sure that he will. I'm sure that he will, one way or another. He'll get where he's supposed to be. But I have to watch that with him constantly. I have a problem with one of the promises is fear of financial insecurity will leave. And that does leave for me sometimes, but sometimes it comes back. And when he was home not so long ago from school, he said, Mom, I need some money. Those words strike terror in my heart. And I know why. They do, because one of the more difficult times of my life was when my husband was unemployed and he borrowed a lot of money from his mother, which caused a lot of problems for the whole family and between us. And when he came to me and said, Mom, I need some money, all those old memories came flooding back, and I got scared, and I went nuts. You know, and I went on and on and on, and he got very upset and ran upstairs, and I got on the phone, and I called somebody, and I said, am I overreacting here? And they said, I think so. I hate that. So I called him back down, and he's a big kid, and he would be very angry if he knew that I'd say this, but he was in tears. And I called him down, and I said, Mark, I'm sorry. It's my own fear it's my own fear. I am afraid. I am afraid because I've seen this before. I'm afraid this is what's happening again. I'm sorry. I'm wrong. And he said, Mom, can't you see, though, that I'm not dead? And I said, no, this isn't a reasonable fear, you fool. This is an unreasonable fear. I'm a sick woman. What can I tell you? And he said, I'm glad you told me that. I never knew that. And I said, well, that's true. I have a problem with that. Maybe we can sit down and work this out sensibly, but you should know that about me. That's a new thing for me to do, you see? And that's something that you have taught me to do. That's new for me. When I'm wrong, promptly admit it. Last night it was late. I had all these kids running around. And I took them to see those Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and they were all karate chopping each other until midnight. It was terrible. And then one went into the basement and turned the light off on a little one and locked the basement door. And I ran upstairs and I said to this kid, "I hate you when you do that." And as soon as I said it, I thought, what a rotten thing to say to a little kid. And so then today, I didn't say it last night, I wasn't well enough, but today I said to him, "You know, I'm sorry that I said that. That's a horrible thing that I said. I don't hate you. I never hate you. I just hate, you know, I hate when things get out of control here, but I don't hate you. That's new for me. I used to let things go forever and ever and ever." The 11th step tells me, the sought through prayer and meditation, to improve my conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will and the power to carry that out. It makes things so much simpler for me today when I know that's all that I have to pray for. I don't have to drag out that list. I don't have to figure anything out. All I have to do is say, I don't know what, well, usually what I say is, "I can't, you must, show me the way." That's all I know to do. I swim in the morning, which for me is an important part of my day. I get up bright and early, and I swim at a local Y from 5:30 until about 6:15. And it's the only time of the day for me that is quiet. I put my head underwater, and nobody bothers me. Nobody yells about missing socks. Nobody tells me I don't have any lunch money. I just go up and down and back and forth in that lane. It's the most boring exercise in the world, but it's quiet. And that's how I begin my day, and it's become a real important part of my day. Because it's quiet and I can think. And some days I just go up and down and say the serenity prayer. And some days I just go up and down that lane and say, "God, heal me. I'm hurt. Heal me." That's what works for me. Some days I say, "God, let me bang my head on the deep end and drown so I don't have to go home. Take me." But that's important for me. And it's also important for me to say prayers throughout the day. And it's important for me to end my night with a quiet moment. And sometimes really, I do sit down and write things out for the day. But I always have to stay in touch with program people. Not because people outside of the program are dangerous, but some of them are for me. Because I get caught up sometimes. I get caught up in that looking good, and I get caught up in things, and I get caught up in appearances, and I'm a great people pleaser. And that's okay until it gets in my way of being useful. And then it's got to go. Then it's got to go. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, I practice this principle in all my affairs, carry this message to other people. I have to admit that the words in the steps say, having had a spiritual awakening as the result. And that's it. That's the result. All those 12 steps should occur in one result, and that's a spiritual awakening. And that never happened to me all at once, but it's something that for me has happened over a long period of time and is continuing to happen as I become more and more aware of the spirituality in my life, within me and among those around me. It's an exciting thing for me to see that. It leads me to great joy, really, and great serenity to know that I am not alone, that there really is a spirit that's alive and doing well. And all I have to do is choose to participate in that spiritual awakening. And some days I don't choose to be a great participator. And some days when I'm feeling brave and when I want it, I do. And those are my good days. But I can only do it one day at a time. And again, you know, I believe that it's a partnership. And it only works when I'm willing to join forces with that power, with that spirituality. Carry this message to others. I just think for me that's such an important part of my program. And the reason is because I get back so much than I give. And I've heard people say that, and I thought they were trying to be gracious, and I didn't believe them for a minute. But I know today that it's true. Particularly with beginners, this is always a valuable experience because it teaches me and shows me the real power of this program. And it also reminds me, on a very human level, of who I am. It keeps me humble. It really keeps me humble. And I believe that we are all in this together. I do try to practice these principles in all my affairs. I've learned to do it. I've got, my own children. A lot of my kids have, they have some problems. We all do. But today, I know a way to work through that. I work a 12-step program. That's all I can do. And when the teachers call, as they do, and say things to me like, "Your child is very angry," instead of saying, "Oh, they are. Oh, I'll make them happy. Hold on a minute. Let me put the phone down. I'll fix this," I say, "I know. I am too. We're all pretty angry here, but I think we're getting better." And that's such a great, that's a wonderful thing, I mean, that's such a freedom for me today that I never had before. And I don't even begin to understand how it works, but I do know that it works. And my own family, for example, and I have said this before, they don't understand my parents, my brothers and sisters. They think I'm pretty much a fanatic, which I think is kind of funny, that I, of all people who, always looked so good and was always so proper, that today they think I'm a fanatic. They just don't understand it, and that's all right. And thank God I know I don't have to explain it to them. But my mother says to me, "Kathy, why do you continue to go to Al-Anon? I mean, Rick is dead." And I say, "Mom, I go because I'm not." Thank you very much for listening.